Mike, how does this feel right now? How does this feel, Brick?
This is poetic. This is poetic. You just gotta watch it happen. The 6-6, Kyle Lowry with the ring, Kawhi Leonard bringing a chip to the city. I want my chips with the dip. That's all I know. I don't want my chips playing. I want my chips with the dip. So bring them dips. That dynasty's over.
Hello, this is Virata. Welcome to your Carlson years, and I got Luke Baristi here with me.
Hello, everyone.
And we are doing a very special edition. It's the week of Blues winning Stanley Cup, Raps winning the title. And so, of course, we're going to touch base on the Ottawa Senators, which is a team that everyone has just got in the back of their minds as they're watching Game 7 hockey, Stanley Cup, as they're watching Toronto win a title for the first time. Everyone's wondering what's happening with your favorite losers, the Ottawa Senators, and their former players as they fail downward in new iterations. And so we're going to touch base on a few Ottawa Senators things, and then we're going to talk about basketball on this hockey podcast.
The first time ever, a basketball discussion. We've suspiciously excluded the two people who are known to be kind of curmudgeons about basketball, namely James and Chet Sellers, because we didn't need the constant... Oh, you only need to watch the last 5 minutes, which take 3 hours, by the way. snipes from both those guys. So this is a basketball-friendly crew.
I also want to really give a shout out to James, though, who held fast to his "you do not cheer for Toronto teams no matter what. If your team is the Ottawa Senators, it doesn't matter what's going on in Toronto with any other team. You do not cheer for Toronto teams." Clearly, I'm not as strong as him. I decided to have fun instead by cheering for a good team going on a fun run. But I really admire his Catholicism-like dedication to a principle. And you know, shout out to you, James. You're a strong man. I admire you.
Yep, I've got another friend who is a fan of the Montreal Canadiens. But she also said, you know, "I refuse to cheer for any Toronto team, and you can't do anything but respect it." So, you know, shout out to, like, sincere shout out to you guys for staying strong in these trying times.
Yeah, keep the faith alive, guys. So let's talk about a couple of things. I think we were going to talk about, because it just happened today. It happened like a couple hours before we decided to do this podcast. Dion Phaneuf was bought out by the Los Angeles Kings, and that has a pretty small impact on Ottawa, just in the sense that because they retained some of his salary, I think the buyout penalty to Ottawa is smaller than what they retained in the salary over 4 years. They have a smaller cap hit. Not that it could possibly matter less to Ottawa.
Man, get your friggin' calculators out, folks. Like, this is the hard-hitting news of the summer, is what are the Senators going to do with that extra $700,000 a year? I, for one, cannot wait to find out.
At this point, I think they've got something like $35 million in cap space or something insane. If you cannot get Thomas Chabot signed to a long-term deal with that much cap space and that much money, then he really doesn't want to be here, folks.
Also, what is the point of that cap space if you're not going to try to sign Thomas Chabot to a low-key sweetheart deal? This reminds me of when the late Mark Stone was coming up, and we were kind of like, there was a lot of discussion in the fan base. It's like, yo, Mark Stone seems like the sort of guy you want to take a risk on, right? And sign him long term. And it turns out that would have been a great idea. And so I'm willing to do what we should have done with Mark Stone and give Thomas Chabot that nice, you know, $6 million deal for maybe, I don't know, 6 years, 5 years, see what he wants, and, you know, really use him as the underpaid linchpin of whatever is coming for the Senators in the next 5 or 6 years.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, so, you know, I was thinking about that Phaneuf. I was just thinking about Phaneuf today, you know, the way that,
as we all do.
Yeah. Just staring into space on my balcony, just thinking about Dion Phaneuf, hoping he's okay. But I was thinking back to many years ago I was listening to a podcast, and the guest was James Myrtle, and they were talking about the deal that Toronto just gave to Dion Phaneuf. And the argument that Myrtle was making at the time, which I think made sense, was that, yeah, that's a lot of money and that's a lot of years and it might backfire on you, but you can't really find another guy who's going to play 20 minutes a night without paying the same amount of money or giving up some prospects or something to get him. So whatever, it's the cost of doing business. Then when Ottawa traded for him, it was almost like the same logic, right? Well, you know, you want a top four defenseman. Ottawa got a bunch of toxic contracts off the books. You know, the worst case scenario for Ottawa is that they pay money for players who don't even play in the NHL, which was what was happening. So they end up getting a guy who at least plays on their roster. And then when he goes to LA, it's kind of the same thing. Well, here's the ghost of Marian Gaborik. And in exchange, LA actually has someone who can play on their roster. At some point, you start asking about, like, should he be playing on an NHL roster? But, you know, the argument, it was at least justifiable every time. And he's just like this player who keeps getting traded for toxic, more and more toxic contracts just on the basis of, well, you know, at least he can play and defensemen are really valuable. So I don't know. Like, I look back at every single transaction with Dion Phaneuf and I'm just like, everybody won because everything that was being involved was garbage. And I don't really know what to do with that except to say that Brian Murray trading for Phaneuf, trading a bunch of bad deals that he handed out for Phaneuf, I'm kind of still okay with it, even after, you know, all these years later. I still think it's a totally justifiable deal.
I mean, I think that trade was rightfully referred to at the time as debt consolidation, because that's really what it was, is that they just packaged up a bunch of contracts, including Milan Mikolic and Colin Greening, and just said, all right, these are expiring, you know, sooner, so we're going to take this one guy. And like, sure, you know, we're going to lose out in the long run, but we'll have to give less money out, in the short term. And then hopefully, you know, we can trade them before, you know, the bad years really start coming. And that's exactly what they did. That plan worked perfectly. Mm-hmm. So I have nothing but, warm feelings and affection for Dion Phaneuf as a guy who was, you know, kind of deece for that, you know, 2017 cup run. Had a big moment scoring a cup overtime goal against Boston. Mm-hmm. Didn't do that in Toronto. Like, if you're going to look at like the iconic Dion Phaneuf moment that didn't involve, I don't know, hitting a dude, that's probably it. So, yeah. But at the same time, I think, I'm sure I've said this before, just listening to you kind of trace the history of Dion Phaneuf throughout the league, he's kind of like, I'm sure I've said this, but he's the opposite of like, taking a paperclip and trading it up for a house eventually. Like, like you start with the house and now Dion Phaneuf is that paperclip.
Do you think he lands anywhere this season? Do you think someone takes a risk on him?
I'm not sure. I haven't watched Dion Phaneuf in the last year. Basically, whenever a player leaves a Senator's uniform, I don't watch them anymore. Mm-hmm. So I have no eye test information about Dion Phaneuf, but I can say that his hockeyviz.com heat maps are not flattering. Mm-hmm. And yeah. So I could see maybe a team that is in need of veteran leadership maybe taking a flyer on him, but I think that's kind of up to Dion Phaneuf at that point about whether or not he wants to, you know, get paid not very much money to play not very much hockey when he could just be at home in Prince Edward Island, you know, drinking a nice white and just enjoying life.
I have this strong gut feeling that he ends up in Philadelphia. I just, they can't help themselves, like big character players who are not good anymore. I feel like that's and they're Philly's that team right now that are like, okay, we don't want to wait anymore, like let's go, whatever that means. And so I think they're going to do some really stupid stuff this offseason. It's gonna be a lot of fun. So the other thing we wanted to talk about just briefly, I think, was that like absolutely heartbreaking anecdote in Elliot Friedman's 31 Thoughts this week about Chris Weidman. Yeah, that is tough. So for those who haven't read it, he's basically saying he had no idea how good he had it in Ottawa before that Uber video surfaced of him talking shit about the assistant coach, which, you know, thinking about that video again, it's kind of funny that what they were saying was very, very true. You know, like it was pretty stat based. Like they were like, he had the worst power play and then they moved him to the penalty kill and then he had the worst penalty kill. Like that's a kind of deserves an answer, you know?
Yeah. When you broke it down, you're like, man, these guys are just, you know, spitting facts here. Like where's the lie? Like why do we live in a world in which you can get, you know, traded simply for telling the truth?
I mean, it wasn't like they were caught on camera being like, this guy's an asshole or I hate him or something like that. They're basically like reading from NHL.com's like team stats page. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's kind of, I mean, I get it. It's bad that it was surfaced that way. But, you know, in a way, like what they were saying was really helpful and interesting where they were like, he shows you what's happening, but he doesn't tell you what to do with the information, mm-hmm. which is like, kind of at the crux of like the analytics community's like current thinking about like how do you put insight into practice, like how do you transfer what you're finding in the numbers into like tools that players can understand and that can they can put into practice in during practice and during games. It's like
just anyone who's been in a, you know, university class knows that feeling of getting talked at and being like, well, I don't know what that means. So
yeah,
better go get a C minus on this exam now.
So the article, they said, you know, he was the one who had the most to lose because he was on, I think he was on an expiring deal or something like that. So he was traded to, I'm not going to get the sequence right. Like I know he went to Florida first, right? Or did he go, he was traded to twice and he only played a few teams and he ended up, on I think three separate AHL teams.
I think it was Edmonton actually. I'm gonna.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. It was Edmonton, then Florida, and then he ended up with Wilkes-Barre, like the Penguins AHL team. And it looks like his career is kind of over, because he's an older defenseman, right? He's like 26 or something.
27. I mean, he was always kind of, you know, sixth, seventh guy in Ottawa, even though he was kind of an analytics darling. He's kind of on that same sort of, you know, Eric Condra, Patrick Wierkosz wave where he doesn't get very much playing time in Ottawa, but everyone kind of likes thinks, you know, this guy deserves more of an opportunity. And then as soon as he gets traded to a team with a spot, everyone thinks, oh, well, this is it. You know, he's going to get his big chance now. And, you know, this is really going to make Ottawa look stupid. And then those guys just flame out, just never to be heard from again. And, you know, you kind of get the feeling, maybe Ottawa's just not that good.
Yeah, so he was traded. So he's 29, so that is his age wrong. So basically, he is what he is at this point.
Being 29 in hockey just rounds up to being dead, basically.
Well, I mean, I also don't really understand what Edmonton was doing. They traded for him. They played him for five games. He had two assists. And then that was it. Then they sent him down. And
I feel like that might have been in the middle of Edmonton's like defense like injury hell.
Because they
were missing out on like Sekera and I think Chris Russell might have been injured at that time too. And they were just like, who's got a warm body? We will give you a fourth round pick for a warm body.
Yeah. And then he ended up in Florida for one game. And then that was it. So, yeah, feel for him. If you don't have a chance to read that, or if you haven't had a chance, it's worth reading. Apparently, Elliot Friedman sat down for like 90 minutes with him and like talked about how this like one bad decision has basically ended this guy's career. And, you know, they went from being in the Ottawa organization where he was kind of, I don't know if it's fair to say he was their guy, but they drafted him. They, you know, they believed in him. And, he went from that to three different teams and in the AHL in like the space of 2 months because of like a bad decision.
I mean, if you're listening out there, Chris Weidman, which I hope you're not, but if you were, I would say, you know, there's always the KHL. There's always the Deutsche Elite League. You know, you've got options and, You know, maybe you can find it within yourself to like really Chris DiDomenico this thing. Go play in the Swiss League for a while and make one more run at the show. And even if you don't, like, Switzerland's nice. They only play like 30 games a season. You get paid in Swiss francs, like the currency with which most of the world's money laundering happens. Like, you got options if you go to Europe. So, you know, don't think of this as an ending. Think of this as a beginning. Man, I could probably do that job that George Clooney had in Up in the Air.
That was beautiful. I felt ready to move to Switzerland.
Yeah, man. Europe's great. I recommend it.
The last thing we wanted to touch on was Erik Karlsson, his status. So he finishes out his season with San Jose, immediately goes for surgery. Apparently, San Jose has offered him like a Drew Doughty deal. So like $11 million a year, probably lots of upfront money, lots of bonuses, lockout proof bonuses. But there was that story, although it was, who was it? Was it Donnie B who reported on it? I don't know.
That sounds right.
Someone on the Sun reported this, that, Melinda Karlsson, God bless her, wants to move back somewhere close to home. And so he's hoping to receive a competitive offer from Ottawa or Montreal. So, you know, what are your thoughts on this? Let's assume that Ottawa would have to at least offer him what was reportedly offered to him before, which was $10 million a year, I think, for 8 years. So, like, would you feel comfortable with Karlsson coming back, like, after what you saw of him in the playoffs?
I mean, you can't... you can't knock Erik Karlsson's heart, even though a lot of people try. And you know, this is a guy who's, you know, played through so many injuries, that we know of, and probably some we don't, in the playoffs. Like, he's a warrior. He should be regarded as a warrior. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons why he's not. And it's probably just because he's a, you know, soft, sweet or whatever. But like, I think, there's no way that you don't want Erik Karlsson on your team because he's going to, you know, risk himself for your team. Mm-hmm. At the same time, like, just from a like physiological perspective, like, how many injuries does this guy need to suffer before you start thinking that's a lot of injuries this guy has had? And, you know, seeing him walking around in crutches at, you know, various Golden State games, mm-hmm. if, you know, because he had groin surgery, like, get well soon, Erik Karlsson. But like, maybe we got, like, I think maybe they should put him on the Kawhi Leonard plan, just be like, yo, you're gonna take some games off. Like,
that's,
I think,
interesting.
Load management might be the way to, you know, handle Erik Karlsson from here on out, because it's not clear that he's able to withstand the full 82 game grind of the NHL regular season at this point. And so if you're a team that's looking to get Erik Karlsson, even if you're Ottawa, I think not only are you trying to pitch him on here's a lot of money, but you're also trying to pitch him on here's how we're going to, you know, keep you healthy. And so you can be at your best when, you know, the games matter most. Yeah, all this to say, come back, Erik Karlsson, but also don't make me regret saying that, please.
Yeah, I have a really hard time imagining him coming back and doing his, like, 32 minutes a night, playing in all situations, just getting, like, annihilated, like every night being targeted by the other team's best line. It's super interesting to think about Ottawa bringing him back and load managing him for a season, being like, well, this was a write-off anyways this season. We want the young guys to get exposure. You know, if he's willing to play here, within, you know, they clearly don't have a cap space problem. It would go a long way towards like rebuilding some trust with the fan base, probably. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it would kind of be awesome, the idea of getting like 6 assets for him and then signing him back the next year.
That would own so hard. Like, who wouldn't love that, like, 17,000 dimensional chess move by Pierre Dorion to trade your franchise defenseman only to bring him back the year later and keep him and the assets? It would be absolutely incredible.
I mean, the worst case scenario is he becomes like a $10 million a year player who is like a basically like Anton Babchuk, who like you play on the power play, but he can't play in all situations, and it's bad for, I guess, if they signed him, they could only offer him 7 years, I think. I don't think they can offer.
Yeah, that's right.
So, like, that's not bad. Ottawa's, like, 3 or 4 years away from being any good anyways. So, like, mm-hmm. worst case scenario, he's a terrible liability, like, for the next 3 or 4 years when we want to be bad anyways.
Exactly.
And then you've got 3 years where, you know, worst case scenario, you trade him or you buy him out or whatever. I feel like 4 or 5 years from now, $10 million a player is going to be nothing. Like, at the way that, you know, the way that salaries are blowing up. I'm kind of okay with it. And there's a lot of recycled Carlson jerseys out in the market that would find new life.
Imagine how cool it would be to have Erik Karlsson as a second pairing defenseman, because your first pairing is Thomas Chabot and Erik Brännström.
Yeah.
Who says no? Who says no?
Bring back Karlsson and Spezza. I think that, you know, that would get people, that's the one thing I can think of that would make people do their best to forget last year.
Man, that is a hooking up with your ex ass team. And you know what? Why not? What do we have to lose?
I mean, the team would be so bad. Like, Spezza is just, I don't, you know, it's just feel good. I don't think I would watch the third period of any game. I just watch the first period. Be like, yeah, there they are. I love those guys.
Be like that no look pass Spezza had to on the goal that made it 1-7 was absolutely sublime.
Yeah, end of the second period, we're down by 4. Time to go read a book. All right, so let's talk about basketball, because that's a lot more fun than hockey right now. I should ask, did you watch any of the Stanley Cup final?
I was in bars where the games were on. Mm-hmm. So yeah. If that counts, then yes.
Yeah,
but I didn't seek it out.
Yeah. Nor I. I did watch game 7 because I was in a hotel room on a business trip with nothing to do but stare at the wall. So I was like, oh, okay.
Oh, I've done that. Oh, yeah, you're in a hotel room by yourself. You're like, this Stanley Cup game's on. Fine.
That's also the situation I was in when I saw that super awkward Chicago Philly final where like Patrick Kane's puck like disappeared mm-hmm. and everyone celebrated while not being able to tell if the game was really over, mm-hmm. which is kind of a nice segue to how that Raps Warriors game ended.
From the sport that brought you the last 2 minutes take too long comes the last 0.9 seconds take way too long.
What a great way to get back at a team that's beating you, though, to call a timeout when you don't have one, causing a technical foul and free throws with 9 seconds left, when the team just wants to, like, explode with joy and hug one another.
It was a 10,000 IQ play.
they're too like, classy to like, call it until it's over. And so no one's celebrating. I think at one point I saw like Serge Ibaka like celebrating and someone being like, no, man, no, don't do it. And so we just, I don't know. It was the most awkward ending. I think I said on Twitter, it's like the spiritual opposite of that like Joe Carter Grand Slam to win the
World. Yeah. I mean, it was infuriating to have to sit there, see the Raptors be ahead with the clock at 0.0 seconds and be like, why haven't they won yet? Why am I not celebrating right now? This is very stupid and I hate it. And so it's kind of like if there was a 15-minute, I don't know, offside review before you got to celebrate your overtime winning goal or something, like just not a fantastic moment.
Also, I mean, despite everything that Danny Green did to try and give the Warriors a romantic path to game 7 by giving the ball away on that last possession. That was crazy. I really thought that this might have been a soul crushing game 6, given that, you know, they were basically playing their bench at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And we're still not really pulling it out.
Oh, I was already making plans for game 7. There was like 17 seconds left. Warriors are down by 1. They've got the ball. And I just knew, like, how would you they not get a basket here?
Mm-hmm.
This is the Warriors we're talking about. They have, like, the Raptors hadn't we looked like they were able to stop Golden State all game, because anytime, you know, they commit too hard on, you know, up the court, there'd always be Draymond trying to find someone, you know, cutting down the back door. So you just knew that they were going to get a basket somehow. And so when Steph Curry missed his shot, which was, you know, probably as good a look as you're going to get in those circumstances, when he missed that shot, it was, I wasn't prepared for it at all, because I'd already emotionally moved past the game, which was another thing that made the whole thing weird, because I was like, the Raptors are going to win. Oh no, now they're going to lose. And then they did win, and it was just too much emotional whiplash. I didn't know what to do with my hands.
That was like an extremely, extremely weird final, given the like emotional high of eliminating Philly the way that they did, and then winning four in a row against the Bucks, and then just like this crazy war of attrition with, like, I wouldn't say bad blood, but like injuries, and just like Toronto did what they had to do to beat like an all-world offensive team. But man, that was like an ugly series at times. Like, is that how you feel? Or like, I've been reading online people being like, that was an amazing final. And, you know, I'll admit, I don't watch enough basketball to be like, really? I thought that was like, we parked like some dump trucks under the rim. And then that was like the basketball equivalent of like lining up four players on the blue line and just like clogging up the neutral zone.
So by and large, I think it was an extremely well-played finals. All the games except for maybe, I don't know, game three were extremely close. And so, you know, even a game that looks like it was going to be a blowout in game two, where the Raptors just decided to not score for the first 6 minutes of the second half, you know, they still managed to, you know, come back and have a, you know, good look at sending it to overtime until the end. And so I think when you kind of had this, you know, when you've got this kind of like aging championship caliber squad, you know, the canonical lion in winter, going up against a team that has, you know, never won a championship before, that's always really compelling to watch. And especially if you have no horse in that race, if you're just in it for the narrative, you're just like, man, you know, can, if Golden State pulls this off with all the injuries they've got, you know, they're going to go down as like the dynasty against which all other dynasties are measured. And at the same time, if Toronto can do this, like, that's a team that's always been doubted, that's, you know, going to finally put that to bed forever. And just so many players on that team, especially Kyle Lowry, who's been, you know, much maligned throughout his career. Yeah, even, you know, obviously Kawhi Leonard is, you know, acknowledged as being one of the best players in the league now, as he should be acknowledged. But going into this year, the question was, is Kawhi going to play? Is he going to be good anymore? What if he just sits out again? And so, you know, this was a real, I think this was a real great finals from a narrative perspective, and also quite a good finals from a basketball perspective. Because, you know, playoff basketball is all about, how do you get those buckets in crunch time? And sometimes it's ugly. And sometimes you just need a guy like, Fred VanVleet to step up and make shots he shouldn't.
Yeah, speaking of narrative, also kind of interesting to see the takes like the day after, people being like, so what does this mean for how you build a basketball team? You know, you don't have any lottery picks on the Raptors at all. You have obviously, like, VanVleet is undrafted. You've got a really like defense forward team. And now that you've got Durant out for an entire season, it looks like Clay is going to be out for like at least half a season. You know, people are sort of thinking about, okay, how do we make this work? Like, how do we take advantage of a 1 year window where some teams are without their superstars? And I saw a lot of like think pieces about how teams are going to start trying to build around a Raptors style, like, defense first, war of attrition thing. And then, of course, like, today the Lakers trade for Anthony Davis, and it's like, no, you're still going to try and get like your nuclear weapon grade player and just like build around a crazy offense. Of course, the Lakers have LeBron, so like maybe that's not a good example, but super interesting to see, like, does this change? Obviously, everyone kind of wonders if like Kawhi Leonard's going to go back, but like, does this change perceptions in terms of like other free agents they can go after if like Kawhi Leonard doesn't come back?
I mean, I think this hidden genius of trading for Kawhi was always that if he didn't re-sign, the Raptors are already on like a super fast, you know, rebuild because they've got Pascal Siakam, mm-hmm. who isn't even close to have, you know, his peak yet. And, you know, a lot of their, like some of their players are kind of old or older anyway. And, you know, where a lot of teams would have like a lot of pieces they'd have to sell off mm-hmm. to like get assets to rebuild, you know, the Raptors already have Fred VanVleet and OG Anunoby, and who was injured for most of the playoffs, actually the entire playoffs, but is also like a really good, you know, bench piece. Pascal Siakam, you know, they've got a lot of good assets that, you know, a rebuilding team would really kill it a hat, like start the real rebuild with. So, mm-hmm. And the other thing that Kawhi leaving would give Toronto is cap space.
Yeah.
They'd be able to, like, they'd be in the hunt for another free agent if they wanted to be. And if they didn't want to be, they'd save it and wait for, you know, someone else to come up next year. So, I think, you know, when you're talking about how does this affect the way other teams operate, I don't know what other teams can do what the Raptors did, because I'm not even sure I know how the Raptors did what they did. the basketball as we know it for, you know, the past decade has supposed to have been, you know, you get your three superstars and you hope to fill out that roster with enough, you know, three-point shooters and defensive specialists to, you know, get them over the line. And the fact that, you know, Toronto just had Kawhi Leonard and then, you know, seven other guys who could or could not step up in any other game. Mm-hmm. I put this question out to Twitter and someone said that this is more of a, you know, Pistons or Spurs vibe where, you know, they've got the one guy you need to, where you know you need to stop, but like you never know who's going to step up in that game from that game.
It's in a way, it's almost like kind of ideal for them. It's like you win a title. A lot of it's out of your control at this point. Like you could, like Kawhi Leonard could decide to leave. Marc Gasol could decide to leave. At that point, you have complete cover to be like, all right, look, guys, we got to rebuild here. So mm-hmm. we're going to trade Ibaka to a contender. We're, you know, I don't know if you build around a Van Fleet, but he's on a super affordable contract. You can probably get something for him on that affordable contract if you wanted to. It's kind of the ideal thing. Instead of it being like, we want a championship, and then now we owe it to our fan base to compete, you know, year in and year out. And that's when you start making wacky, bad decisions. In this case, you can be like, look, we want our championship, and then Kawhi left. You know, what are you going to do with that? We have to do the smart thing. And so we're going to rebuild. And, I don't know. In a way, they're in a good place. No matter how it goes, even if it would, you know, it'd be super painful for them to suck next year. But
I mean, maybe it would. Maybe it wouldn't. I think, you know, if I can't really imagine like getting mad about whatever the Raptors do next year. surely winning a championship gives you at least a year of immunity to like whatever else happens from that point forward, right?
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think anybody really cares.
Also, I don't know. Just all praise to Masai Ujiri, who, you know, made the bold moves he thought he had to make. And, you know, I think something that I think he deserves a lot of credit for is doing the draft strategy that everyone says you should do when you're drafting kind of later in the first round. Mm-hmm. Which is swing exclusively for home runs. And, yeah. You know, go for those high risk, high upside guys, because when they hit, it's like finding $100 bill in your jacket. Like it's going to help out. And so a guy, so I just think about this dichotomy between a guy that the Raptors drafted too high. Maybe you know the name, Bruno Caboclo or Caboclo. I can't say his name right, but he was considered famously, so famous that it turned into a meme, the Brazilian Kevin Durant. Like that was the idea for how high this guy's ceiling was. And if you've never heard that of Bruno, that's for good reason, and it's because he's not very good. But at the same time, you know, Masai reached for Pascal Siakam at, you know, 27th or whatever in the first round, and you know he's easily the second best player on the Raptors most games. And so, you know, that really, I think, shows the strength of that strategy, is that, you know, you're not going to hit on all those picks that you swing for, and sometimes you're going to end up looking kind of silly, but you know, when it works out, like it will work out some of the time, like it's the way to make money with those late first round picks.
Yeah. And you know, do you think Siakam's going to be the type of guy that they can build around, like in a post Kawhi world, if it comes to that? I mean, I don't really know enough about, I know he's young. I don't really know enough about whether he plays like an ideal position to build around, though.
That's a good question. I think Pascal's going to be a good kind of second banana complimentary piece. Mm-hmm. I'm not confident enough to say that Pascal's got the superstar potential where if he's your best player, that's a championship caliber team. But I do think that, you know, he does a lot of great things on the floor in terms of his, you know, just ability to score and play defense, that I think he'd be a very attractive player for anyone to want to play with. I don't think you can watch Pascal Siakam play basketball and think, oh, I don't want to play with that guy.
Yeah.
Like, he'll get on the end of passes. He'll play D hard. He's going to push the floor in transition. You know, these are the sort of things that, you know, don't necessarily always show up in the box score, but just make your team better over the long run.
So it seems like this run kind of did the impossible and made it possible for us to like get behind a Toronto team. And I think they did it by being like the most winning in the most hater way possible, like embracing their outsider status, playing a like well-rounded defensive game, making impossible shots when they needed to, going down early so people would continuously write them off. I forget sometimes that they lost their first game against Orlando. Really just like making it like tapping into Canada's like inferiority complex / underdog status, however you want to cast it. And it was super, super fun to get text messages from people who live like nowhere near Toronto, being like asking if I was watching the game here, and like if there's any Toronto Raptors people here. And I will say, so for those who don't know, I live in the Bay Area. There aren't a lot of Toronto Raptors fans here, but I also don't really think there's a lot of Warriors fans either. Like, people do not give a shit about basketball. Last year when the Warriors won, I didn't hear like a single like car horn. I was living in San Francisco. There was no like 100,000 people like in the main square or anything like that. I don't know what is going on with the energy here, but people are like in bed by like 9:45. A championship game like really screws up your like hour and a half commute to Menlo Park the next day, I guess.
Man, I think part of that is just that the Warriors made winning so routine. And like, I think they went through the entire like last playoffs. Like, I think they won like 16 games and lost a single game, or like, yeah. One year they almost swept to the championship. I think that was last year.
Yeah, last year they lost one game, I think, in the finals.
Yeah, and so like why does that deserve why does that deserve honks? That's just being just like waking up and being like, oh, it's sunny out today, cool. Like yeah. that's what's supposed to happen.
And it's so effortless. Like those I'm fucking traumatized by those Klay Thompson threes, you know, in six games. It was just it seemed like every time he shot the ball, he's the opposite in Kawhi in the sense that like, I feel like I'd watch a whole game and be like, has Kawhi made a single basket? And then like at the end, you're like, oh shit, he has 36 points.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas like Klay Thompson, you'd be like, he has scored every single bucket for the Warriors.
Yeah, Klay Thompson would get the ball and you'd be like, not this guy. And then he'd make it. You're like, nah.
He would make these impossible shots or just like beautiful, beautiful shots. And he'd be like, man, he scored every single bucket. And then you'd look at the end of the game and be like, he's only got 22 points. Like he was outscored by Kawhi Leonard, who he takes a lot of free throws, Kawhi Leonard, but like, just such different styles. And I really think that like people in the Bay Area who have been watching the Warriors lately, and they've only been watching the Warriors lately like in the last half dozen years or so, are really like, I hope they don't think that's how basketball works, you know?
Like, oh God. Can you imagine the come down after like watching a team that literally reinvented how basketball could be played? Like imagine this, it reminds me of when I watch football with like quarterbacks that aren't Aaron Rodgers, where you're like, oh, Aaron Rodgers never throws interceptions and you always know he's going to make the right choice. And then when you watch any other quarterback, you're like, this shit is terrifying. Anything can happen. He could throw an incompletion. He could throw an interception. He like might misread the coverage. Like how do normal fans deal with this stress?
I can't even imagine Warriors fans. Let's say the Warriors have to rebuild in the next few years. And a few years after that, they end up with a team that wins the way that the Raptors won this year. I can't even imagine people like coming to accept that after like watching like 4 or 5 years of just impossible, beautiful threes.
Yeah.
Like going in just like effortlessly. I don't know how you like win a war of attrition that way. And people around here, I think, have like a really fatalist approach to sports where like they don't seem to celebrate that much the wins. They're super cynical about the Sharks, for example, even though you're like, man, the Sharks are in the playoffs every year. What are you even talking about? They like went to the finals not that long ago. I don't really know what it is. I don't know if it's because the Bay Area is a lot of transplants or if they've just like seen what like an algorithmically generated perfect team can do. So there's no sense of struggle anymore and there's no investment.
I'm tempted to draw a parallel between, I don't know, like some sort of, you know, tech optimization culture in the sports team that, you know, whenever something goes right, it's like, that's just the way things are supposed to be. And whenever something goes wrong, you know, it's because of some unforeseeable black swan event, like, you know, two of your best three players getting injured in the same series or whatever, you know.
But definitely.
I'm going to save that for the long form Medium piece, in which I draw unflattering parallels between the Golden State Warriors and Uber.
I definitely didn't experience a single person going like, oh, hey, this must be culturally significant in Canada. Like just like putting themselves in like in someone else's shoes and being like, everything we're doing is a social construction and totally meaningless. Your meaningless experience must have been fun compared to mine. Everyone is like, there's not a lot of humanities majors, I guess is what I'm saying. Everyone here is like, the immediate reaction was, you only won because of injuries. And you're like, ugh. You know, you can still be a human being and be like nice for a day and be like, hey, congrats. Like that was fun.
Also like, are you telling me that Golden State has never won a championship because their opponents suffered injuries? Like I vividly remember like Kevin Love and Kyrie Irving being injured in one of the series against Cleveland. Like it is what it is. Like,
yeah,
you know, injuries are temporary, but banners fly forever, baby. So
it's the journey too, right? I mean, the whole thing of like, them going down against Philly, them going down against the Bucks. I really didn't think they were going to come back against the Bucks the way they did. And it was like such a beautiful series too. I think that was the best series of the four.
I mean, considering the turnaround that happened where they went from like not even looking like they should be in the same league to just playing this suffocating style of team defense that completely flummoxed the MVP of the league. Like that was a really remarkable series.
Yeah.
I don't like, I still don't know how they did that, because I remember after the first two games, it was kind of like, all right, I mean, well, they had a good run, but what are you going to do?
There have been a lot of super fun conversations though, of people being like, hey, so Raps won. How many people are in Canada? okay. Let's get to basics. What are your exports? what are your major, do you still have a staples economy? Okay.
Just a complete, I mean, like half the country put on the like game six at some point, mm-hmm. according to the TV ratings. And like, there were multiple just like outdoor communal viewing experiences in, you know, Canada, coast to coast, from Halifax to, well, you know, at least Saskatchewan. Maybe Vancouver's too cool for that sort of thing, but like, I know that it turned up in a lot of places. And so how do you not have like a sense of, I don't know, curiosity or occasion about that, where you're like, that's kind of interesting that an entire country has put aside their regional differences, except for James, to like cheer on the one, you know, Canadian team that's left.
I mean, I hate the Toronto Maple Leafs pretty fiercely. And I can still say that like a Toronto team winning the title is about as close as we get to like an Olympic men's hockey team, like winning a gold or something. Mm-hmm. Like, so it's okay to do that. Everyone's got like an aunt or an uncle or like a friend who lives like in Mississauga and voted for like a Ford brother, and you don't know how to get along with them. And you're like, okay, this is a bridge. We can build on this. Like we can find some way through our partisan reality just based on like a team. They literally don't have Toronto written on their jerseys. They have North. And you're like, okay, like they're making it easy for us. We can do this.
Yeah. They did incredibly well in the branding game. I will say this, and I've been thinking about this, and it occurred to me, I finally figured it out this afternoon, because I was thinking about James's admirable anti-Toronto stance, and which in most cases I would be extremely on board with, but there was something about the Raptors that I found extremely easy to adopt, and it crystallized for me this afternoon, because, you know, the Raptors has always been kind of the team that doesn't get taken seriously. The fans don't really get taken seriously. They're a team that has never been able to attract big name free agents. They're a team where all their best players have left and tried to win elsewhere. And it just hit me that Toronto is the Ottawa Senators of the NBA. And that's why I found it so easy to adopt them, is because all that feeling of just like never being taken seriously and, you know, wanting to win out of spite as much as it, you know, making you feel happy, you know, was extremely familiar to me.
Yeah. It's like, this was an extremely relatable run. And I do have one anxiety though. You know, the run was relatable because it tapped into like the entire country's inferiority complex. And if Kawhi Leonard resigns, it's going to be the most like satisfying thing in the world, because he was traded to a team he didn't want to go to and then won with them. Mm-hmm. If he resigns, it sends this signal that it's like, no, you know, you just got to spend some time there and then you get it. If he doesn't resign, I'm really afraid of the psychic damage that it does to like everyone who bought into this concept that, you know, like, let's embrace our outsiderness and we're going to win on our own terms. And then if he chooses to go to the Clippers because, like, which, you know, can you blame him? Like, there's a, you want to sell sneakers or something, like LA is probably a good place to do it. But I'm afraid it's gonna be a dark time for a couple of weeks at least after that happens.
So every Raptors fan like should have known going into this season, you know, under no circumstances should you catch feelings for Kawhi Leonard. Mm-hmm. Your man is here for a good time, not a long time. Mm-hmm. And yet, if he does resign elsewhere, that will be the first time in, I think, NBA history where a superstar has left the team he just won a championship with. Mm-hmm. And so I'm trying to talk myself down, because I always said, you know, don't get attached to Kawhi. And, you know, if he wins a championship with Toronto, like, put up a statue immediately. Like, he could go on that parade and be like, I hate Toronto. Screw all of you. And then, like, sign his contract with the Clippers in the middle of the parade. And I'd still be like, you know, bring the statue in, retire the number. Like, let's get this guy what he deserves. And yet, in the, like, ever since they won, I'm like, man, he can't leave, can he?
I mean,
he's gonna leave this.
I have to. Come on. I have no idea how the NBA salary cap works. So I look at how much salary Toronto has committed, and I'm like, I don't really know what that means. Like, in terms of, like, there's player options and there's luxury taxes and there's various other things. I've read it.
Have you gotten into bird rights yet?
Oh my God. Yeah. I listened to a whole podcast explaining what that is, and I've forgotten all of it. I guess that's where, like, the team that holds your rights can offer, like, substantially more money than if you leave as a free agent.
Yeah. So, something like that. But, like, the extra money they offer, like, doesn't count against the tax or something. Like, it's extremely weird.
Oh, okay.
That's probably wrong. I know nothing about the NBA contract structure, nor do I care to. It seems confusing.
I read somewhere that Toronto can offer Kawhi Leonard a max deal, which is like $180 million over 5 years or something ridiculous. And they also have room to go and get another player almost as good. And I don't think they can offer quite a max contract, but something really, really good for another, like, complimentary star. I think if Marc Gasol doesn't take his player option, or if they, like, make a trade or something like that. So it'd be kind of interesting to see, like, so Kevin Durant is out. He was supposed to go to the Eastern Conference, and he's out. You know, obviously LeBron James is in the West. So you've already got, like, the number one and two best players in the league out of your hair for most of next season. It'd be super interesting if Toronto said, look, you know, take your player option or whatever, we'll sign you to a max deal. You still got a window here. If you go anywhere else, if you go to the Clippers, you're not going to go to the Lakers because they just traded for Anthony Davis. So if you're going to go to the Clippers, then you're rebuilding there, I guess. I know rebuilds in basketball never really take that long, but you can win again here next year. Like, absolutely. Like, we've already shown that we can beat the Bucks. They're basically the only other team. I guess Boston is still on the up.
Well, Kyrie could go, so that could be. Like,
yeah.
That Boston team was miserable all year.
Toronto is like, there's an argument to be made that they're the team to beat in the East if Kawhi Leonard stays, and they could get better. They could add. They have room to add.
I love how they win the championship, and you're like, man, is Toronto the number one team in the conference? Maybe. Like, yeah, I think you've nailed it there.
that's why people come to this Ottawa Senators podcast for basketball analysis. The defenders have a chance to be a favorite next year.
Yeah,
lineup stays the same, and they add a good player.
Anything could happen, folks.
Yeah,
what we're saying is possible.
I'm taking a really going out on a limb here to say if Toronto improves next year, they'll be possibly the best team in the East. I don't know. I think that I read this, like, really smart piece about how Masai had built this whole team around getting good right when Boston and Philly start to decline, that they're the sort of like heir apparents in the East. And, you know, everything was going to be built around being good in like 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly they were like better than expected with DeRozan, to the extent that they could trade for Kawhi. And so, you know, now you're in this weird space where you're like, well, the heir apparents are still apparently like Philly and Boston, but you just beat Philly and Boston was bad all year and you had no trouble beating them. So like, what do you do? Maybe you're the champs now. Like, maybe we should act like the champs and defend.
I mean, I think Boston's washed at this point, but I mean, it's hard to imagine the 76ers not being close to the level they were at this year. Same thing with Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, if anything, I think the last two rounds of the playoffs like reflected best on the 76ers, because you watch that 76ers series back and it's like you realize that's the team that gave Toronto the biggest scare. And you know, I think Philadelphia could be closer to championship caliber than we maybe gave them credit for. Yeah. 2 months ago.
Yeah, for sure. I think wasn't one of those games went to double overtime, and then obviously yep. got the like buzzer beater in game seven. Like that's totally different game if like they go out in the second round.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's talking about Toronto like they're not a model to copy, but they're like a disappointment if they like lose a game against Orlando to open the series at home and then go out in the second round against Philly. Like everyone would be like, well, that was a huge bust.
Yeah. Bye-bye, Kawhi.
Yeah. Well, it's been educational. I think I like basketball a little bit now. I might even watch some regular season games next year.
That's a bad idea. Actually, so like watch the good regular season games where it's a good team against a good team. But if it's just like any random Thursday and you've got like the Raptors playing the Pelicans, like uh-huh. hard pass. That's like at least bad hockey kind of takes on this, you know, anything can happen horse race aspect.
Uh-huh.
Bad basketball is unwatchable.
Also, I know we're bouncing back and forth between basketball and hockey here, but I really want to admire the fact that the NHL, already a sport that's mostly random bullshit, decided to add completely random refereeing bullshit this year. So like now on top of everything else, you have no idea whether somebody is going to insert themselves into the game and just like 5 minute major, not call a hand pass, whatever, like just the most random garbage. I'm psyched, you know, Ottawa could win the cup next year. I don't know.
And because it's hockey, like that stuff happens. And then that's the thing that everyone blames for whatever the big loss is. But, you know, if my team was assessed incorrectly, a 5 minute major, you know, in the last 10 minutes of a must win game seven, I would simply kill off the penalty rather than allowing four goals on the subsequent power play. Like, it's easy. Hockey is easy to play, folks. You just don't allow the goals on that 5 minute major. And then you just go home and stack paper. I don't know why this turned into the ref's fault when that, you know, penalty kill couldn't stop anything. Like, what do you want? Like, did the ref make you allow all those goals? No? Well, then shut up.
Yeah, your goaltender who's like number five all time or whatever it is now and like wins and you're paying him $7 million a year. You know, I didn't see anyone being like, maybe Fleury's washed again.
Also, getting mad at like a missed hand pass, like easy thing to miss, by the way. It's not like the ref looked at the hand pass and said, let him play. It was just a missed call. There's 1,000 of those every game. Like it happens. Like, is this your first time watching hockey? I don't understand. Like, and yet people are saying this has like been the worst officiated playoffs in forever, and like how is it worse than usual? I don't see it. It's always been this bad.
Yeah, I think that's the right take, is being like it wasn't especially bad. It was just bad during like what seemed to be meaningful times.
Mm-hmm.
Versus just like most of the year when it just couldn't matter less.
Exactly.
And the fact that like the Blues were in last place in January and won the cup, it's like, I don't know how anybody makes a living in the hockey prediction business. Like how anybody at like Hockey News or Sportsnet like wears a suit and they're like, what differentiates me from the bloggers is my professionalism. Yeah, yeah. Totally. I listened to a 2-hour long podcast where all he did was talk about the Tampa Bay Lightning.
Yeah, I mean, not that we didn't fall prey to that, given that the last podcast we did was Tampa Bay going up 3-0 in game one and being like, well, guess that series is over.
Yeah,
just
absolutely.
Before Tampa Bay gets swept.
But I'm standing in my kitchen. that's the difference. I make no claims to authority at all. I'm just a guy on the internet.
Yeah, fair enough.
All right, thanks for listening, everyone. Hockey's on in 4 months. See you then.
Later.